This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on Talk Louisiana, we will hear from Stan Harris, the head of the Louisiana Restaurant Association. Stan Harris will give us a review of what's happening 2 years removed from the start of COVID, which has rocked his industry. The National Association is asking for more relief from Washington. And as we've seen here in our communities, many restaurants are still on the ropes. Some have not reopened, and others are taking their sweet time about doing so. We'll talk about it with Stan Harris. Also, we lost a major person in that industry in Baton Rouge. Richard Cole, co-founder of DiGiulio's, died yesterday, 74 years old. Also, William Dalrymple, his book is The East India Company, Corporate Violence and the Pillage of an Empire. It's a fascinating book about India from many years ago. That and more, but now the news. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Your number is 877-217-5757. Send emails to talk@talklouisiana.org. We're joined at the start by Stan Harris, the man who heads the Louisiana Restaurant Association. Stan's been with us a few times over the last few years, and it has been a perilous time for his industry. The COVID age has not been good for restaurants, and you can imagine for good reason. And before we get started, a point of personal privilege. Yesterday we lost Richard Cole, the proprietor of DiGiulio's, along with Mike Johnson. Richard Cole was one of the co-founders of that great restaurant at the Perkins Road overpass. May 15th, 1987 it opened, so coming up on 35 years. And Richard unfortunately left us yesterday at 74 years old, but he was a fine man, great laugh, and dispensed much wisdom with the pasta. He was quite a gentleman, and he will be missed. And Stan Harris, I know you know everybody in the industry, and I'm sure this is a great loss for those who share your passion for food and restaurants.
Yeah, there's no question about it. Thank you for having me back. It's always a pleasure to chat with you, Jim. And, you know, Richard and the DiGiulio brothers and then Mike coming into their business, you know, they opened a few months before we opened the first TJ Ribs that was horrible on Highland Road before we moved to Acadian. And, you know, there were a lot of restaurants coming together around that time in that area around Perkins Row and, you know, Highland Road and repurposing on Acadian. So very good memories of going to DiGiulio Brothers.
And most restaurants, I would imagine, don't really last, certainly don't last 35 years, but many of them fail. It's a tough business, isn't it?
No question. It's not for the faint of heart. You know, you have to be resilient and you have to be resourceful and you have to have your own sources of capital to sustain yourself for that period of time. And some of the things we're seeing today, just outside of COVID, or the supply chain challenges. I think you might have seen the article in The Advocate about the price of seafood and crab meat. It's at historic levels because not only do they not have the product, they don't have the people to process it. It costs more to package it. It costs more to transport it.
877-217-5757 is your number for Stan Harris, the head of the Louisiana Restaurant Association, and has a long history.
And I get to serve on the board of the National Restaurant Association too. So we're starting a national board meeting today. As we're sitting here with this action that I think Jim prompted a lot of discussion, trying to get Congress to consider another round of restaurant revitalization funding. They came up with $28 billion last time. We needed another $42 billion to make these folks to fill every request that was on there that was unfunded. And we're going to continue that push. I was in Washington last week for a couple of days, and that's what we're talking about, trying to figure out how we can get back these jobs, how we can get back the opportunity, and show the folks in our industry a future.
The National Restaurant Association's latest survey found that 88% of restaurants saw indoor dining demand wane because of the Omicron variant. So it seems like just when you are turning the corner, things go south. That has to be a disappointment. But is it going to cause more trouble for the full year? Or is this something that is just a wave that will go past us and you'll get on your way?
Well, as you and I have talked before, restaurants and bars are cash flow businesses. And when the cash flow changes, the last person to get paid is usually the owner and the operator. And that puts them at risk. And when we talk about the fact that, you know, business conditions are really for 75% almost report that they're worse than they were 3 months ago, and 75% say that they're less profitable than they were. So, you know, you can't continue to have these ebbs and flows. We're seeing restaurants that have reduced seating capacity, reduced hours, reduced days of operation. When I got back from D.C. the other night, we were looking for a place to eat in Metairie when we landed in New Orleans, and it's really limited after 9 o'clock at night, and the places that we had available to us didn't have everything on the menu or everything that they would normally offer from their bar. So it's a set of challenges, so we ask folks to please be patient, please be kind. We're doing the best we can right now.
Again, 877-217-5757 to talk with Stan Harris, president of the Louisiana Restaurant Association. And we're a state known for our food and for our restaurants. And two of the big ones, the two biggest cities, New Orleans and Baton Rouge in particular. And how is it looking, a listener asks, and it's obviously a logical question for you, in New Orleans and in Baton Rouge?
Well, New Orleans has its own set of challenges with its vaccine mandate or proof of a negative test. And that's really hurt us with a lot of the locals. They're just choosing to go to an adjacent parish and spend their money there. So we've lost a lot of our local business. It's no secret that we're having a problem with public safety, and we've got the police chief and district attorney and the city council all talking about what we can do to address some of these challenges. Our carjackings are up and things like that in New Orleans, and that's not creating an environment that's conducive to people wanting to come and visit. So I chair our New Orleans and Company, our Convention and Visitors Bureau this year. We're working on How do we change the image of our market? We created a music event last year, NOLA by NOLA, in the fall. We're going to enhance our restaurant week this June. We're going to support the fairs and festivals. And in just a few months, we've got the NCAA Men's Final Four coming to town. So we still are a destination marketplace, but we've got some challenges that we're going to work through with this new council and see if we can find some solutions.
And what about Baton Rouge?
Well, Baton Rouge, you know, what's really good about Baton Rouge, and I have a soft place in my heart because it's where I grew up, we've had a great relationship with the mayor. She has been really sensitive and her team to what our industry's needs are as we've looked at mitigation for COVID. You know, I can't say enough about how the market has become more resilient. We've got more options. We've got more creativity. We've got really, every time I drive a street in Baton Rouge, I see something new that's popped up, some sort of new concept, somebody who's repurposed a building, put it back in commerce. I love the resiliency of our industry, and I love the creativity of our people who really do believe that I can do it better than the last guy or the guy next door.
Now, we've seen some old line restaurants in previous discussions with you, and it's been a few months. We always get questions, for example, about Jubin's, one of the traditions of Baton Rouge that's been on the shelf now for a couple of years. How's it looking there?
Well, I can tell you from the information I have, because one of the principals there, Mike Boudreau, is my boss this year. He's the chair of Louisiana Restaurant Association statewide, and Michael and I talk regularly each week. And they are underway. They've signed a contract to do some renovation and upgrades. We're really excited about this. They're looking to try to get this open as soon as possible. But as with everyone, as I talked to an operator in New Orleans yesterday, he has two small neighborhood restaurants ready to open. He just can't get enough staff right now.
Yeah, that's a question another listener asked about how difficult it is to hire people right now. I mentioned Louis was a 24-hour establishment. Now it's an 8.5-hour-a-day establishment, and that's due to the shortage of workers. What's going on?
Well, you know, the first thought of this was that people were leaving the industry early on because the industry shut down, and they would not come back to work because there was enhanced federal support for unemployment. What we've really found, and I've talked to our Federal Reserve president here, we chat once a quarter, and they made a great comment to me. They said, this is a structural change. Logistics, telehealth, administrative work in healthcare, things of that sort, where people don't have some of the vagaries of maybe income in a service industry, has pulled people out of the industry, and they thought it might take a year, two, or even three to recover the jobs that we need to support our industry. So, you know, when you look at the fact that Amazon hires 1.5 million people just for their last mile warehouse delivery, that makes a real challenge to our industry that's competing for the same worker.
But moving forward, is this going to be a continuing problem, or is it too early to tell?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a continuing problem for us at least through 2022 and probably into 2023. But if we can get this pandemic move to an endemic and an endemic move to a seasonal issue where we're managing it with options for vaccines and things of that sort, I think that we can start to build some more confidence because, you know, I have a daughter that lives in New York City. When we were up there, you know, the vaccine mandate's in place. But I can tell you that the restaurants aren't as busy as they were at the last visit. And, you know, they can sustain themselves at 75 or 80% for only so long because the business is built, the cost structure is built, the rent and lease and tax obligations and insurance obligations are still there. So as I've told you before, we still have risk for a lot of our member operations, especially in full service. Our quick service people have been able to adapt to more going through the window, more using delivery, self-delivery, third-party apps and curbside, but it's still a challenge.
Tyler and Jefferson, let's try to get you on before the break. Tyler, you're on with Stan Harris. Good morning, sir. Hi, Tyler. Bring him up, please. Okay, we lost Tyler. I tell you what, we're going to take a break. We'll see if we can get Tyler back, and we've got a few others waiting, and there are two lines open, 877-217-5757, your number. We'll have one more segment with Stan Harris of the Louisiana Restaurant Association. Perilous times, but as we've noted, many restaurants have stayed the course and are looking forward to better times in 2022. We'll talk about it with Stan Harris when we return after this 90-second pause on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Caroline Menville Alasso is producing today. Let's go to Clayton on Essen. Your number is 877-217-5757. Clayton, you're on with Stan Harris, president of the Louisiana Restaurant Association and board member for the National Association. Hi, Clayton.
Good morning, gentlemen. I don't know if it's so much of a worker shortage as it is a compensation shortage. Asking people to show up for less than $3 an hour and then hope for tips is not a way to get good talent. You pay peanuts, you get peanuts. Thank you.
All right. Well, most establishments do well enough that waiters and waitresses sometimes make very good money, but there are others, Stan, where tips are not plentiful, and $2.13 an hour is a difficult wage to make it on. Your thoughts about Clayton's sentiments?
Well, I look at total compensation. People go to work where they feel like they're treated well, they like what they're doing, they like what they make, and they like the opportunity. No one forces anyone to work anywhere. I started out in the restaurant industry at $1.90 an hour. I didn't think that I would spend my entire life there in that particular job. Unfortunately for me, I've been in the restaurant industry my whole life, and it's treated me really, really well. It's created a lot of opportunity. I've made some amazing friends and contacts. But from the same time, when you talk to that employer and you're looking at going to work and they're able to pay that, and that's what the market is established as that particular wage, that's what's going to drive it. I think you've seen from our standpoint, you know, we were the only industry, the major industry, that didn't oppose the governor's minimum wage approaches in the legislature when he brought those up. We still haven't because I thought what he was approaching us was very reasonable. But, it's a debate that's gone on for a long time. But there are people that like the industry. They don't want anyone to work with it. In Washington, D.C., the city council eliminated the tip credit wage a few years ago. And after an uprising from the industry workers, it was repealed and it was put back in place. So I'm going to defer to the folks that are in the industry that want to be there and take it from there.
All right. James N. Carville says, Stan, do you think the rise in what he says very rude customers over the last 5 years has contributed to the decline of people wanting to work with the public?
Possibly, but you know, we also have some really nice people that dine in. I try to tell people, and Jim, I've said it on your show before, you know, the word I use is extend a little extra COVID courtesy. That person that's working the door might be struggling. That person might be have worked another shift, you know, yesterday and the day before. We've got a lot of restaurants, especially in our communities right now, that are open Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and maybe part of the day Sunday, and they're structured to be open 14 shifts a week. They would like to get back to normal. They would like to get back to serving you like they used to, with their full menu, their full complement of hours and opportunity, take care of your group business and things like that. But it's just not possible right now because of the vagaries of what's happened with these variants from the COVID impact.
877-217-5757. Still time to get in with Stan Harris. David in Atlanta. David, you're on with Stan. Hi, David.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm amazed at the gentleman your guest just said. I've talked to many tip workers, and they've told me they have worked sometime for virtually nothing. Many people stiff the tip workers, and I can't imagine people going home with virtually no money being made and working a full day.
Well, that happens, but Stan, unfortunately, it doesn't happen most of the time, or we wouldn't have any workers. David's right about that. And as I stated, you worked at some high-end restaurants. Some of these waiters and waitresses make very good money, over $1,000 a week, I'm sure.
I would tell you that when I sold the company from Ruth's Chris back, we had about 25 or 30 of our service people across the board that made in excess of $130,000 a year as a server. So I've seen both sides of this. I understand that someone who's working in a diner may not be making the same wage, but it's really up to that employee to negotiate with their employer, just like I do every year, as to what I feel like my worth is.
$130,000 a year as a server.
And, yes, sir.
And that shows that most people, and I think that is a, you know, we talk about bad things in our community. We live in a place with very low income per capita, but we have a very generous population, and I think most people do the right thing, and they go beyond 20%.
Of course.
20% is the bottom, not the top. Trish in Grand Coteau. Well, go ahead. I'm sorry, Stan.
I was going to say, and Jim, it's the structure of what we've done. You know, in Europe and in other countries, they've gone to a service charge mentality. So if you're comfortable, I like the idea that the guest gets to decide how much they want to put into this gratuity. And I think that that's an important thing to consider, that you have control of it. If it was a flat service charge of 20%, you don't have any say in it. So, and it's a little different. So, you know, again, it's a point I like to distinguish.
Trish in Grand Coteau. Hi, Trish. You're on with Stan Harris.
Good morning. As a self-employed person, I never, ever know what kind of income I'm going to have. And I just can't imagine being a waiter or waitress, and you never know if you're going to be able to pay your bills. I mean, there could be a snowstorm. There could be all kinds of stuff where customers aren't coming in. You could get a shift that's not particularly lucrative. I just can't imagine the uncertainty of never having a guaranteed amount of income that is even going to buy you food, much less.
All right. Well, if you're working at a place where you're in that kind of a predicament, I can understand how this probably is a perilous line of work. But Stan just pointed out
it's certainly not for everybody, Jim. And I understand that, you know, as I tell people regularly that look at the industry, I said, if you're a person that needs a robust set of benefits and a robust set of backstops in your life, you might want to look to work in a hotel. You're probably going to give up some of the benefit of the top line income. But I can tell you, I can find you just as many people that have worked in the industry a long time that have made a great living doing this, and they wouldn't do it any other way because they like the way it's done.
And for those in the service industry who are fortunate enough to make in Baton Rouge $130,000 a year, I would think the logical thing to do would be to budget for about half of that. And then if you do great, then you have money that you save and you can save for a rainy day. But
when someone's making $30 or $40 an hour working, you know, 30 hours a week to 40 hours a week, which probably doesn't happen, that's on the low side of that. So if you're thinking about that, that's someone that's making $75,000 to $90,000 a year in Baton Rouge, and that's not an unreasonable occurrence there.
Morgan and Gardier. Morgan, you're on with Stan. Hi, Morgan.
Hi. Two questions. One, with the growing crime due to loss of wages and COVID lockdowns, I'm wondering if there are any plans in the restaurant industry to combat that by ensuring that our recidivism rate goes down, by ensuring that we're hiring previously incarcerated individuals. And second question, is it appropriate for the public to be subsidizing an employee's wages through tips, or should that just be built in?
Well, Stan,
I think I've already talked about the difference in a service charge environment versus not. And there were some in New York that tried it. Danny Meyer tried it in some of his restaurants. They've rolled it back in some others. Again, it's a business model. When it comes to crime and recidivism, you know, the National Restaurant Association Education Foundation has a program called HOPES, which is we help others return to and reenter society, that works with the U.S. Department of Labor and the Bureau of Prisons and some of the state corrections associations, bringing people back in and creating opportunities for them to work. So we're always going to do that because we're part of the community and we want to be part of the success of all these communities.
All right. Phil in Jefferson Terrace, please be brief. We'll slide you in before the break. Phil, you're on with Stan Harris. Hi, Phil. Good morning, sir. Mine too.
A good waiter can make a good living anywhere in the world, but it's a matter of being compensated rightly. And I worked for Café Du Monde, and it was a wonderful experience. And anyway, thanks.
All right. Janice, from St. Louis, I believe. Janice, you're on with Stan Harris.
Sykeston.
Okay, go ahead, Janice. You're on with Stan. Please be brief.
Is this U.S. Bank?
Okay, hold tight. I think we've got a caller who dialed the wrong number. But, Stan, thank you so much. Let's talk again soon, my friend.
Jim, it's always great to speak with you. Take care, my friend. Appreciate it.
This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. Always good to catch up with Stan Harris of the Louisiana Restaurant Association. And if you missed the beginning of the show today, we are mourning the loss of Richard Cole, the co-founder of DiGiulio's, great Italian restaurant in Baton Rouge, started in 1987. And it has continued in full bloom for many, many years at the Perkins Road overpass. And Richard Cole, the co-founder, along with the DiGiulio brothers, John and Fred, passed away yesterday, and he did so at his office at the restaurant. He listened to this show almost every morning. I would go there frequently, and he would often critique the show. And it was a pleasure to have him as a dear friend. I will miss him immensely. And the proprietor who has the keys to the kingdom is Mike Johnson, who's been running the show there for the last few years and doing so quite well. But we will miss Richard. He had a zest for life that was uncommon, a man who had heart issues going back to his 30s. And his cardiologist, Dr. Carl Lucard, did a wonderful job keeping him going for many, many years. It was not a case that he could go forever. I think he had at least two bypass operations. So Richard Malcolm Cole lasted much longer than you would have thought, and quite possibly because of the love he provided to others and the love he received from his clientele and for those who were in his orbit. August 23rd, 1947, Richard Cole, to January 24th, 2022. Rest in peace. And we're joined now by a fascinating gentleman who is calling from across the waters. And when I say across the waters, he's in India. And you know what time it is in India right now? It's 9:05 p.m. 11 and a half hours.
It is.
And it's William Dalrymple, who is the author of 9 books.
Hello there.
About India. And good morning, sir.
Good morning. What time is it with you guys?
It is 9:35, 33 in the morning, so we have a bit of a time difference, But your story has gained great reviews.
I'm wide awake.
Well, the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times have both commended this story that William Dalrymple has told. It's now in paperback, The Anarchy. And here is a sample of what the New York Times wrote about it. Superb, a vividly and richly detailed story. The greatest virtue of this disturbingly enjoyable book is perhaps less the questions it answers than the new ones it provokes about where corporations fit in the world, both then and now. In the Wall Street Journal, as William Dalrymple shows in his rampaging, brilliant, passionate history, The Anarchy, the East India Company was the most advanced capitalist organization in the world. Mr. Dalrymple gives us every sword slash, every scam, every groan and battle cry. He has no rival as a narrative historian of the British in India. The Anarchy is not simply a gripping tale of bloodshed and deceit, of unimaginable opulence and intolerance, intolerable starvation. It is shot through with an unappeasable moral passion. So August 1765, the East India Company defeated the Mughal Emperor and set up a government run by English traders who collected taxes through means of a private army. And what happened over the course of the next 47 years, William Dalrymple?
Well, it wasn't a happy story for India. There was a very happy story for the shareholders of the East India Company in London, as you can imagine. So, the Mughal Empire was not just a rich part of the world. It was the richest country on earth. And in the 18th century, provided about a quarter of the world's GDP. The idea we have today that India is a poor country is really a very new idea. For most of history, India, with two harvests and incredible mineral resources and brilliant craftsmen and amazing artists, has always been one of the richest and most skilled parts of the world. And in the 18th century, the Mughal Empire, which was this extraordinary empire, which ranged all the way from Kabul down to southern India, split up and all its component parts sort of disappeared into a civil war. And this gave a private English company run for profit by merchants the opportunity to take over town by town, enemy by enemy. And in as little as 50 years, this company conquered India. It was not coming out of Downing Street, out of the Foreign Office. Mm-hmm. It was coming out of one office block in the city of London. And effectively, they did what any business would do if it could. It basically asset stripped the richest country in the world and turned Britain from a fairly marginal country on the edge of Europe, rising in wealth, but still, not competing with the French or the Italians. The East India Company turned Britain into the richest country in Europe and ultimately the biggest economy in the world in the early 19th century.
We're talking 255 years ago when a boardroom in the city of London, you said, had control of one quarter of the GDP in the world. Is that correct?
Correct. And this is something that didn't affect just India, but it also affected the rest of the globe, because once they conquered India, they used it as a base to grow opium, turning themselves into the biggest narco operation in world history, and made the Medellin cartel or our friends in Colombia look like very amateur figures. They used this opium to buy... They sold it illegally in China, fighting two opium wars for the right to sell these drugs. And with that, they bought tea, which they then sold in India, in Europe, and crucially for your listeners, in what was soon to become the United States. And it was East India Company tea, which was turned out into Boston Harbor. And what we've forgotten is the degree to which the people of America in the run-up to the revolution feared the East India Company, which had such a ferocious reputation for asset stripping and and for bending governments to its own will. But they worried that the East India Company would be let loose on them too.
Well, it's an epic story, the anarchy of how the East India Company took over large swaths of Asia and devastating results of a corporation running a country. Now, we hear today about how government should be run like a business. Well, it's happened before, and it didn't work out very well, did it?
It didn't work out very well at all. And by the 1770s, there was a massive famine in Bengal, and the company didn't think it was any of its business to provide soup kitchens or anything else. It was there to make a profit for its shareholders. And so a quarter of the population, maybe more, of Bengal died. And when they sent out their troops into the countryside to gather taxes mm-hmm. despite the famine, the shareholders in London, when they got their full tax collection, despite this terrible, terrible famine, the shareholders voted themselves an increase in their dividend from 10 to 12.5%. Utterly heartless behavior. But that's what happens if something is run, you know, a country is run just for profit, just for shareholders.
A listener asked, this is Tom on Bluebonnet, a good one, about the challenges India faces now. It is a country of dire poverty in many aspects. Is that related to what happened 2.5 centuries ago?
Well, to a certain extent, yes. I mean, India obviously has been independent of Great Britain for 70 years now. But there's no question that British colonialism turned this country, which was very rich, into a country that was basically very poor. I mean, the figures were roughly that India produced about a quarter of the world's GDP, and when the East India Company was founded during the reign of Queen Elizabeth I in 1600, England was producing just, you know, a few percent, 4 or 5% of the world's mm-hmm. GDP. By the time 1947, that India gained independence, those two figures had been more or less reversed, that Britain was producing about a quarter of the world's GDP. And India was producing just single figures. And India is now obviously coming up again. The Indian economy hasn't yet managed to do what the Chinese have done. But most economists believe that it will do in the next century. And what we're going to see is India come back to life and stop being a country which is thought of at all as a poor country and again be remembered as a very rich place. Mm-hmm.
There was substantial violence, wasn't there, as a result of trying to preserve this massive treasure trove that was one quarter of the GDP of the entire world? How substantial was the physical and personal violence against people?
Well, the great trick that the company pulled off was that when the Mughal Empire disintegrated, there were, you know, a lot of soldiers without a job because their paymaster had disappeared. And the East India Company recruited a vast private army. It wasn't just a few security guards, although that was how it started off. It was actually by 1799 exactly double the size of the British Crown Army. There were 100,000 troops in the British Army just before the British rearmed to fight Napoleon, culminating in Waterloo. In 1815. At the same time, there were 100,000 troops in the British Army. There were 200,000 Indian troops, effectively mercenaries, working for the East India Company. It was the largest professional army in Asia. And this, as I say, was not working for the British Crown or the Foreign Office. This was at the behest of a boardroom of directors in Leadenhall Street in the City of London.
Well, thank you, William Dalrymple. A fascinating story, The Anarchy, an important book about then and now. And we will return with more Talk Louisiana after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is our number, and David Rudolph is with us, one of the preeminent trial lawyers in the nation, specializing in high-profile and complex criminal and civil rights cases. He's represented individuals in civil rights litigation against law enforcement agencies arising from wrongful convictions. His book, which is related to this, is called American Injustice. And good morning to you, David Rudolph.
Good morning, Jim. Thank you very much for having me.
Obviously, you believe that our criminal justice system is flawed. How flawed is it in your judgment?
Well, you know, it's flawed because it's human. And all of us as human beings have our flaws. It's just that when those flaws are applied in the situation of a criminal investigation and criminal prosecution, the consequences can be overwhelming. And so I think that it's not a question of corruption. It's a question of human limitations and of the best way to find answers to try to minimize the problems that exist. And that's really the point of the book.
You say nearly 2,800 people have been wrongly convicted. This is in the last 30 years, serving prison sentences, many of long duration, and then they've been exonerated and released, combined jail sentences adding up to more than 25,000 years of prison time. How can this happen in our country?
You know, well, I think it happens primarily as a result of confirmation bias, which is a psychological phenomenon that all of us, every single person, suffers from. And it's simply this. When we settle on a theory about something that happened, and it doesn't much matter what it is, you know, we can take the election of 2016 or 2020. Once you settle on a theory about what happened, all of us, no matter what our persuasion, will tend to focus on the evidence that supports our theory and to disregard or discount the evidence that's inconsistent with our theory. It happens all the time. In police work and in police investigations, the police will come upon a scene and they will, based on their experience and intuition, they will come up with a scenario, a theory about what happened. And once that happens, and they focus on a suspect, they, like everyone else, suffer from confirmation bias. And so they tend to ignore the facts that are inconsistent with their theory and focus in on the facts that support their theory. And that is, in the vast majority of cases, what leads to these wrongful convictions.
The guest is David Rudolph. The book is American Injustice. You suggest that procedures used to make an eyewitness identification of a suspect are flawed. Why?
Well, the procedures need to recognize that human perception is flawed. You know, our memory is not like a video recorder. It is subject to influences and outside impact. And so we need to have procedures that guard against that. In years past, the procedures did not guard against that. In more recent years, as a result of recognition that these procedures are subject to human fallibility, we now have adopted in many states, I don't know if it's been adopted in Louisiana, but if not, it should be, what's called double-blind lineups. And what that means is that the person who is conducting a lineup, in other words, you know, you have a suspect in a group of people, and you bring the witness in, the eyewitness in, and you ask the eyewitness, you know, do you recognize any of these people as the perpetrator? Well, the person who's conducting that is blind in terms of the facts. He had nothing, or she had nothing, to do with the investigation. Therefore, they can't give any cues, conscious or unconscious, to the person who is being asked to identify someone. That's not because people intentionally try to skew the results. It's unconscious. So we eliminate that by having a double-blind lineup, and the person who's conducting it knows nothing about who the suspect is, knows nothing about the crime, knows nothing about the evidence, knows nothing about the witness. And that eliminates what otherwise can exist in terms of bias. And that's a good example of how we can improve the criminal justice system and how we have improved it in recent years, at least in many, many places.
What about cross-racial identification. This is a good question from a listener. Mike in Goodwood asks about that. That quite often seems to be a flaw that white people, for example, have more difficulty identifying a black person than they would another white person. Does that play into what you're talking about?
Well, of course it does, and it's not just limited to blacks and whites. And I don't mean to cast aspersions, but I can't tell you the number of times that I've been in a restaurant that has Asian servers. And I can't necessarily identify who is my server. Whereas if the person is white, if the server is white, I don't have any problem identifying it. It's simply a matter of not being familiar enough with the particular characteristics of that race, whether it's someone who's African-American, someone who's, Latino, someone who is, Asian. We just have trouble with that. And they have trouble with identifying white folks. It doesn't all go one way. And so we need to be particularly sensitive in those situations to not allowing any kind of bias to creep in, not allowing any kind of influence to creep in. And frankly, even when the identification is pure in the sense that there hasn't been any improper influences, it's still a questionable identification because those kinds of identifications are just difficult for anybody.
Now, it's been 27 years now, but I remember the O.J. Simpson trial, and I think he was guilty of killing his wife and her friend, Ron Goldman. But I also think that Mark Furman was fully capable of planting evidence. He may have planted evidence on a guilty man. How big of a factor is it in fabricating or planting evidence for the purpose of implicating a suspect in a crime?
Well, and that's a really good example of what we call noble cause corruption. And that is where the police believe that someone has committed a crime, perhaps properly, but there is, for whatever reason, an absence of real evidence that they can rely upon. And so someone like a Mark Furman may decide to plant evidence, not because he's trying to set up or frame an innocent person, but because he is afraid that the real perpetrator is going to get off. And I think that's what got exposed during that particular trial. And I think that's what ultimately led to the acquittal, because the jury decided they just couldn't trust anything that the prosecutor had put forward. And I think they were angry that Furman had done that. They were convinced he had done it, and they were angry about it. So that's a really good example of how noble cause corruption, which is really just a fancy way of saying the ends justify the means, can adversely affect the criminal justice system, even in the sense of someone who is guilty getting off, because that's a perversion of the justice system as well.
Now, also David Rudolph, the author of American Injustice, notes that many interrogation tactics coerce what you believe are innocent defendants into giving false confessions. How is this process done? Is it obviously intimidation, but how does it happen?
Well, most of us would think we would never confess to something that we didn't do, let alone plead guilty to something we didn't do. But the interrogators are trained to create psychological pressures on individuals, particularly, if you take the case of a Brendan Dassey in Making a Murderer, people who are perhaps mentally challenged in some way, young, sick, addicted to things. People who are vulnerable, in particular, are subject to these pressures, and police are trained in how to take advantage of those kinds of pressures and vulnerabilities. What that leads to is confessions that are simply unreliable. The police are allowed to lie to suspects. They can tell them they have evidence when in fact they don't. When the consequences of someone not saying something are explained to them as a possible death sentence, whereas if they'll simply, tell us, how this happened, or maybe you don't remember it, but, how do you think it would have happened if you did it? And the person, explains it. And then all of a sudden they've confessed. It's a very real phenomenon, and we know it exists.
Well, David Rudolph, we do have to roll, but it's an important book, American Injustice, from David S. Rudolph. You can go to davidrudolph.com. Signature support for First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Back tomorrow. Stay safe. Stay tuned.